Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Delighted to be in conversation today with Jim VanderHeide. Jim VanderHeide is president and CEO of Capital New York. He holds the same titles at Politico, a nonpartisan media company he helped co-found in 2006 to cover politics and Washington governance. VanderHeide, along with John F. Harris and All Britain Communications, launched Politico in early 2007 and quickly established it as one of the leading new media companies in the nation, a must-read. The success of Politico inspired the purchase and expansion of Capital 6 years later. VanderHeide is a lifelong journalist covering Congress, the White House, and politics for the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post for the better part of a decade. Before helping launch Politico, his interest gravitated towards strategy and the business end of media as Politico grew. And Robert Allbritton announced in the fall of 2013 that VanderHeide would serve as his CEO in both publications. VanderHeide has been recognized as a leading new media thinker, Vanity Fair naming him as one of the 100 most powerful information age thinkers for helping create the model for the new media success story, unquote. In December 2009, VanderHeide was selected to be the first representative of a primarily online news organization to serve on the Pulitzer Prize board. VanderHeide, a native of Oshkosh, Wisconsin, is a regular political analyst on MSNBC's Morning Joe and is a frequent guest on numerous cable and network television programs. He co-moderated with MSNBC and CNN two televised presidential debates during the 2008 campaign, including the first debate to incorporate questions voted on by a live online audience. VanderHeide graduated from the University of Wisconsin-Oshkosh in 1994 with degrees in journalism and political science. He was awarded an honorary doctorate from UW-Oshkosh in 2012, prompting his children to mock him for being a, quote, fake doctor, or what my mother-in-law might have called a phooey doctor. VanderHeide is married to Autumn Hannah VanderHeide, a policy and development consultant for nonprofit organizations. They have two children, Sophie and James, and reside in Alexandria, Virginia. Welcome, Jim.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Well, it's terrific of you to take all this time considering what you've been doing. So let's go back to the beginning. What kind of kid were you?
What kind of kid was I? I was a troublemaker.
Were you?
Yeah, I was one of those kids who took a good 20 years to find himself. And I mean, I was a normal kid, loved sports, loved hanging out, but I was not into school. I really wasn't a good student really until college and really until I got into journalism and really found my passion. I think it happens with a lot of us. You find a passion and it gives you a level of focus that you otherwise don't have in your life. But I love Wisconsin. I love growing up there. My family's still there. I still consider myself a cheesehead, even though I've been gone 20 some years, but get back there a lot. And I really love Wisconsin.
Well, we have that in common because my first book was Strengthening the Wisconsin Legislature.
Oh, great.
Rutgers
when
University.
Was that?
Rutgers, you know, I don't even remember when it was, but it was in the 60s. I can tell you that. And we just went online and bought a rare copy of it for, I think, $2 on the web.
So, you had to buy your own book?
Well, they're all gone. You know, during our fund drives, we had about 10 of them, and we offered them as incredible giveaways and premiums. And people would get them, and I would say, these books are very important because everything in it is wrong. So so you might want
it. But it's a collector's item. I love it.
So collector's item, it is. So you were a regular kid. You were a Wisconsin cheesehead. Did you like politics back in the day?
I really wasn't that into politics until about 1992. And I really got instantly hooked on politics once I got into politics. And really it was Ross Perot's presidential campaign where I sort of matched sort of my own mischief genes to be able to have someone from the outside make an argument that was different from what the establishment was saying. I found it very appealing and was really hooked in a kind of a sick way because I became not just addicted to the presidential campaign. I became heavily addicted to C-SPAN. And I would come home even after going to the bars and I would watch hearings late into the night. I was fascinated by the legislative process, fascinated by policymaking and sort of how people utilized their power. And that really was that was sort of the gateway drug, becoming addicted to politics and the media.
Amazing. Wisconsin's an amazing state because it had a huge distance between the left and the right. I mean, that was a state of guys like Joe McCarthy and all the way over to David Obey on the other side, and you had a wide distance. Is that what you attribute to your sort of nonpartisan analytic stance?
I don't know. I mean, Wisconsin has fascinating politics because it has what you just described, these ideological extremes, but it also has a nice, rich history of sort of going its own way.
La Follette,
having these sort of independent-minded voices. And even in the 90s, if you think back to sort of the Republican Party of yesteryear that was really driven by the governors in the Midwest, like Tommy Thompson at the time was an innovator on welfare reform and other issues. So Wisconsin's always sort of marched to its own beat. It's been somewhat sad to watch in the last couple of years where I go back to Wisconsin, particularly when I go to Madison, and it just feels like I'm in a small version of Washington, D.C. It's become so radioactive. Even when in the past, when there were ideological extremes in Wisconsin, there was still a politeness. It's like Midwest polite, and you don't have that in the politics anymore. It's very rigid, often very nasty, very personal, certainly when Scott Walker took on the unions early on, really viscerally nasty for a lot of people who are participants on both sides of that debate. And that's changed. I think it's one of the big changes in politics.
I was there at a time when the governor was Warren Knowles, and his brother, Bob Knowles, was the president of the Senate.
Right.
It was a family affair.
Yep.
But I used to take some of the kids that I knew from New York City to lunch, and I would see these guys I was interviewing, the Republicans, and kids would have their hair down to their behinds, and the Republicans were sort of looking at me. So there was always some ideological distance, I think, because you had the University of Wisconsin, and the kids were quite liberal.
Very liberal.
And then on the other hand, you had the legislature sitting there, and there were guys who would take off on the newspaper, the Daily Cardinal, every day from the floor of the Senate and yell about, you know, a bunch of communists. So it was a fascinating time, and I loved my time there. It was a long time.
Well, it's an unusual state in that you have Madison. It's almost a state in of its own. Like, Madison is not Wisconsin. Madison, like you said, is
the People's Republic of Madison.
Yeah, exactly. It's a very, very liberal area, very highly educated area. Yeah. You know, the rest of Wisconsin, not that it's not highly educated, it's just very rural. It can be quite conservative in lots of places. And so it's just, Madison is not, to me, is not like a microcosm of Wisconsin. It's a microcosm of itself.
Of Madison.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's go to your enterprise. Tell us about Politico, how it got started, and what do you attribute its amazing success to?
Well, once I got into college and figured I wanted to be a reporter, I thought that's what I would do my whole life. I mean, I loved being a reporter. I worked really hard, and maybe I set my expectations too low, but when I came to Washington, my only goal was I wanted to work at Roll Call newspaper, and I wanted to cover leadership, congressional leadership.
Was Roll Call by that time sort of established itself? Because when I was working around Congress, Roll Call was a place where secretaries sat on the side of the desk.
It by that time it established itself as sort of as the campus newspaper for Capitol Hill, and the one place that was really interested in sort of power politics at the leadership level, which I love. I love to study the people who get to the top and why and how do they utilize their power. And so that's all I wanted. I came out to Washington, did a bunch of internships with the whole aim of one day working at Roll Call, which I did within a couple of years of being out in Washington. And I tell this story a lot to especially kids who are not from big cities and are from the Midwest, that you come to Washington, you come to New York, you're so intimidated. You assume everyone is so much smarter than you. They might be better educated, have gone to better universities than you.
And where did you go to university?
University of Wisconsin.
Wisconsin. And you did you do graduate work there too?
I did not do any graduate
work. Okay.
I had a double major in political science and journalism.
Important message there, but go ahead.
But even to get into the University of Wisconsin Oshkosh, I couldn't get in there. I had to go to the University of Wisconsin Menasha Extension, a two-year college, just to be able to get into college. And even before that, there's a famous family story that my parents and I were sitting in the guidance counselor office my senior year in high school, and I said, I know my grades aren't great. I graduated in the bottom one-third of my high school class. I said, but I want to go to college. And she's like, you're not going to college. I want you to talk to Billy Stuber over here. You're going in the military. I'm like, but I want to go to college. She's like, there's no college that's ever going to take you. And my dad's like, the hell with that. You can find someone will take you. And so I went to the extension and eventually got into Oshkosh and eventually got out here. So it just took me a lot longer to get out here. But once you get out here and you have this sort of pragmatism that comes from being in the Midwest, I think I had to work hard to get there. And you'd realize at each level, like, huh, these people aren't that much smarter than I am. And then you get up to the next level, you're like, huh, these people aren't that much smarter than I am.
It's true.
And you realize that if you work hard and you have good work ethic and you're a relatively smart person, you can do pretty big things once you get into the system of Washington or New York. Like, once you're actually in, you've made contacts, people know who you are, you've proven yourself, you can really do a lot of stuff. And so I thought, well, I just want to cover politics. And I eventually, you know, got to the Journal and worked at the Washington Post. I covered the presidency, covered Bush.
Well, how hard was that? Don't just skip over it. I mean, to get to cover the president for the Washington Post, that's one of the most prestigious jobs in journalism. How'd you get it?
I got it because I think with each job, I was able to show that I was a good reporter. I think at the end of the day, I had a knack for breaking news. I think I'm blessed with a gene, right? I really don't. Without the exception of my family and friends, I don't care what people think of me. And that might seem a nasty thing. Like, I never cared. So, like, when people got mad because you wrote tough stories, I think a lot of reporters, they flinch at that, where it's like, I just did not care. Like, if I knew I was writing the truth, that's all I really cared about. And I was able to write a lot of really interesting pieces along the way and be able to attract the attention of editors, which is the way you get a better job.
Do you remember one that you were really proud of at the Washington Post?
Even before the Washington Post, I'd say the stuff I'm most proud of was when I worked at Roll Call. Like, back when I worked at Roll Call, and this is so much of life, as you know, is timing, right? So I'm at Roll Call covering Republican leadership at the one period in history where people are more interested in the speaker, Newt Gingrich at the time, than they were in the president. There was that famous Time magazine cover, like the shrinking president, and basically, you know, Newt was the man at the time. And I covered Newt Gingrich's rise and fall. And I was, at the time, I had written a piece. It was a great, in retrospect, a great story, and I still have the video. I'd written a piece before anyone knew that there was going to be the impeachment of Clinton. I had found out, because I'd worked the leadership so hard, that they had been meeting secretly and trying to find money from this slush fund that they had set aside for committee chairman to be able to secretly begin the proceedings of figuring out how that would work. And this is before anyone thought they were serious about doing that. And it was a huge, at the time, just a bomb of a story. And the next day I get a call and they said the Today Show wants you to be on. Well, here's little Jimmy Vandehye with his like sports coat that doesn't fit and his crappy shoes. And I'm on the Today Show looking like I'm 12 years old talking to Katie Couric and Matt Lauer about some piece I just wrote for Roll Call. And it was, to me, like, it was just eye-opening the potential you could have if you could write really interesting pieces that people felt like they had to reckon with. And I was just hooked on that type of reporting. And I think ultimately I went from there to the Wall Street Journal. And
but before you do, I want to ask you something, Jim.
Yep.
Did you see any of the human flaws in Newt Gingrich that we have subsequently all seen?
Oh, yes. I mean, they were so blatant. At the time, it was such a great story to cover because you had Newt Gingrich was speaker, Dick Armey was majority leader, Tom DeLay was minority whip, and John Boehner, now the speaker, was then the conference chair.
It's amazing.
And all four of them thought they should be speaker.
Right.
And all four of them had staffs that loved to leak. So any meeting that they would have, they would all want to download about how dumb the other person was because they ultimately wanted that person's job.
And how would they do it? They'd just call you up?
Yes, or call her. I'd stake them out, and you'd get the stories, and they all disliked Newt. They felt he was just so, what we saw in the presidential campaign, he is both like a genius in sort of his intellectual capacity, but he is so erratic in his leadership style, and it drove people crazy because there was this famous book at the time, Tell Newt to Shut Up, and it was all based on they just couldn't get Newt to stick to one position, and the minute he'd have a meeting with people, he'd walk out and switch it in public. And so there was this term, like, just tell Newt to shut up, because every time that he would speak, he would shift things for Republicans and cause chaos.
So he was both erratic and erotic, because what really did him in wasn't the famous visit to his ex-wife coming out of the ether.
I mean, he was obviously proven to be a hypocrite based on leading the impeachment proceedings for someone having an affair when he was having an affair himself with one person being on congressional staff. So he couldn't have had a bigger, more blatant example of hypocrisy. At the time, it wasn't known. It wasn't written about it. It was known about subsequently. But his the erratic nature of Newt, the leader, it was so up to
But don't you remember when Newt went, was it Livingston who came next?
Well, briefly. So yes. That was the other big story.
That's the whole
had.
Point. Yeah, was that your story?
In the time, it seemed like I had this huge scoop. I was the first person to write that he had an affair and he was going to step down. I really only had about, at the time, a two-hour jump on everyone else, but we had just started to figure out the internet, and I was able to post it and get credit for being I knew I had the letter. Somebody close to him had slipped me the letter that he was about to read to his entire conference saying, I've been having an affair and I'm not going to be speaker.
And the whole premise of getting the job was that he wasn't Clinton.
And he wasn't Newt. He was like, he was the safe pick. And it turns out, as we've seen over the last 20 years, like, there are not a whole lot of safe picks left in Congress. But that was another one where all of a sudden you get out and like everybody wants to interview you. You go from, you know, TV show to TV show. And that's right as cable's exploding. And there was this insatiable appetite for congressional coverage. And Newt was just Newt and Livingston and all this chaos was great box office, great coverage.
Have you ever been threatened as a reporter?
Yeah, I mean, you have people threaten you like no one's ever going to talk to you again. We're going to shut you off. I've never had someone say, I'm going to kill you. I've heard people say you're an F this or whatever.
Right, right, but right, right.
that's nothing. I mean, it's not like being a war correspondent. You actually have the potential to get killed or be captured and truly face threat. Like, Washington threat is, I always tell our reporters, it's meaningless. They have no tools against you. If someone tries to shut you off, you can find, any clever, hardworking reporter can find a way to get the information that they need to know. And you don't need sources to say, oh, I'll work with you or I won't work with you. If a politician says, I'll shut you off, I'm like, fine. Eventually they come back.
I know I'm running all over the place, but can Andrew Cuomo be president of the United States?
It's hard to see right now that he could be president of the United
States. Why do you say hard to see?
Because I believe Hillary Clinton, this question about is Hillary running or not running, she's been running for president for months. She's done every single thing you do when you run for the presidency. If she runs for the presidency, I don't believe anyone with real ambitions is going to challenge her, at least unless something really
radical
shifts.
By the way, he told me that a long time ago. He said, I can't be because, you know, she's going to run.
She's going to run. Even if she didn't run, I don't know that he's a top.
Let's say she doesn't run. What happens then?
I would say if she doesn't run, he certainly isn't that group of people who would be taken seriously. I think the drop-off between Hillary Clinton and Andrew Cuomo is enormous, and that's what Democrats should fear. If she does not run, the drop-off, and I wouldn't just say this about Governor Cuomo. I'd say this about Governor O'Malley. I would say this about even Elizabeth Warren, anyone else that we're talking about as a candidate. What you have to remember about the Barack Obama era is that he was tremendous, has been tremendous for the Barack Obama brand. But that the party has really suffered. So the DNC, I would argue, is weaker than it's
been in some time. Democratic National Committee, yeah.
Democratic National Committee, weaker than it's been in some time. They've lost state House seats. They've lost governorships. They've lost House seats and Senate seats under President Obama. And so whoever the next candidate is not going to really inherit a very strong party. So what Hillary Clinton has is Hillary Clinton essentially has her own political party.
And her brand.
Her own brand, her own base, her own funding mechanism. She does not really need the party, per se. Andrew Cuomo would need the party. O'Malley would need the party. Anybody else who runs for the presidency as a Democrat would need to do serious work, serious repair work on the infrastructure of politics. And I believe in a 50-50 nation that infrastructure matters. You have to be able to raise the money. You have to be able to target the voters. You have to be able to get on the ballots. Like, all those little things, they matter. They might not matter decisively, but I think they matter immensely.
But I guess my question, Jim, was we know in New York State what this governor is or purports to be, but how does somebody in Wisconsin feel about him? How does somebody in Montana feel about him? What do they think? He has a distinct New York accent. I'm just wondering whether or not he is the kind of force that we see him in New York as.
My guess is that the vast, vast majority of the people in the states you mentioned have no clue who he is and have no clue who the governor of New York is. People just don't pay that close attention to politics. I think once his national profile was raised, if it were to be raised, he would have problems in that I don't know if the independents out there or even sort of the skeptical Democrats are looking for someone necessarily from New York who's not a Clinton to be the standard bearer for the party. I think he'd have to overcome that accent and stuff like that. I don't think he can overcome all that. He's not a household figure. And I would say I'd put him in that category of everybody else other than Joe Biden. Joe Biden's the only other person who wants it badly, who's virtually certain to run if Hillary doesn't, who has some brand recognition, who people know who Joe Biden is. Now, the other problem with that is, like, people know who Joe Biden is. And there's, like, half the people would scoff at the idea that he could be president and half would find his story, his personality appealing. And so Hillary's not there. It really is Cuomo versus Biden versus Warren versus O'Malley.
So, Jim Van Der Heide, tell us who the Republicans have.
There's a couple ways to look at it for the Republican Party right now. In the short term, if I were a Republican, the thing I'd worry most about is a sugar high in the short term. In that 2014 is, I think, going to be a very good election for Republicans. I think they've done a really nice job of getting the right candidates in the right states to give themselves a plausible chance of winning back the Senate. It's a sugar high. It does not mean that the public has suddenly warmed to Republicanism. They just dislike both parties immensely, and they just dislike Democrats a tiny bit more than they dislike Republicans right now. And they've done nothing to get at the fundamental problem facing, almost an existential question facing the Republican Party, which is you cannot be the party of old, white, straight, Southern Christian men.
And non-Hispanic, non-women, you know, I mean,
exactly.
Obviously that's the other side of what
that's the
saying.
Other side. That is the reality. You can't lose Asians by 50, Hispanics by 40, gay voters, women. I mean, the young people, they're losing every demographic other than older white people. And that's just not, you can't put together.
Why don't they say that? They don't seem to be.
I would say that is the fundamental divide in the Republican Party. Some do see it. I think if President Bush, former President Bush, were sitting here, he would say exactly what we're saying here, which is the party needs to change radically and rapidly to appeal to minority voters and to female voters, or the party is not going to win a national election. And they've not done anything that I have seen that would appreciably change the view of a Hispanic voter or an Asian voter of Republicanism over the last couple of years. And I think in retrospect, history will show that was a terrible mistake, largely because they have to be able to start winning Hispanic voters because it's the fastest growing population demographic in national elections.
We're talking with Jim VanderHei, who's president and CEO of Capital New York and co-founder of Politico. So, Jim, the place that we're looking at now is Washington. We've been talking about Washington. Now let's talk a little bit about New York. What's Capital?
Capital, I think to understand Capital, we should talk a tiny bit about Politico, if you don't mind, which
sure,
is because it's totally based on Politico. Politico was an idea we had 7 years ago, which is, listen,
it's only 7 years old.
Only 7 years.
It's amazing.
It's aged me much more than seven, but it's only 7 years old. And Politico was just based on this idea that we believe there is a significant population of people who care immensely about policy, politics, and governance. It's not everybody. It's a small group if you look at it as a totality of our population, but there's a substantial group of people. And that if we can own that group, if we can be the go-to source for people who really care about policy and politics, that you could build a really nice business that can fund the type of journalism that I got into the business to practice.
Okay, but let me just back off and say, before you, there was National Journal, there was Roll Call, as you mentioned before, there was CQ Magazine. How do you differ from that?
We differ from it in several ways. One, all the folks that you just mentioned, and almost everybody we were competing with when we started Politico, they were really built on an old model. They were built around a hard copy newspaper at the end of the day. And we're very focused almost exclusively on the digital product. We are a website. We're a mobile site. We're very focused on speed, on basically making sure that we're getting information to people when they want it, which is as quickly as we possibly can get it to them. And we're very big on believing not all reporters are created equal. You've got to find the people who can break news or tell you stuff you did not know.
Which so who is do you what want? People want? People like you.
I want people like a young Jim VanderHei when I was in the game.
You oh,
want
you know.
People. I'm 43.
A mere child.
I'm a child. I feel
okay.
Older, right?
Okay. And you go looking for those kinds of journalists. Now, I teach journalism. I teach young people. So what do they have to be to get a job with you?
They have to be good. And they have to be not just good. They have to have the potential to be great. And one of the things, I could spend an hour talking about this.
Should they go to Harvard?
I could care less where they went to school. And maybe that's my bias is that I went from
I'm with you. Go ahead.
Who cares where you went? Like, can you work hard? Can you break news? Are you fearless? Can you write? And do you have the potential to be great? I don't want, like, we live in this culture where everybody's a winner. Like, not everybody's a winner. And I want the people who are winners. I want people, and not just the people who are winners, but who want to win. Like, when I'm a reporter, like, I get really irate if someone beats me on a story. I want people who pull their hair out when somebody beats them on a story, because you want to be first to the information. You want to be the smartest. You want to be the fastest. So
I haven't heard the word nice in this. Let me just interrupt for a second and say that I've taught the Legislative Gazette seminar for years, and some of the brightest young people have gone through it. And let me just say that they're not the winners. The winners are the people who pull your teeth out in order to beat you.
It depends how you define nice. Like, I don't really care if somebody is nice. I want people to be good people. Life is too short to work with jerks. So you could be extremely ambitious and still be a good person. That doesn't mean that you're just, like, nice. Like, nice doesn't cut it. If nice means that you get relationships with a lot of sources and get great information, then be as nice as you possibly can
be. Yeah, but the guy who writes the A paper at the university is not necessarily the great reporter, as you yourself have pointed out about yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, and so you find great talent everywhere. So you're talking about teaching a class. Like, you're looking for the kids who are going to work hard, who are going to out-hustle the competition, and who want to push themselves. There's only, especially as you get into this era where media companies are going to be smaller, you need people who are sort of self-motivated and can push themselves to be as good as they can possibly be. And if you put those people in one place, you can crush the competition. Like,
crush them like a bug.
Crush them like a bug.
Do you interview them personally?
At this point, I don't. I mean, unless it's a real high profile hire, someone who I believe I can make a difference on by trying to recruit them, I typically don't. I still do weigh in a lot on different people that we're considering hiring because I read a lot. I read a lot of politics and policy stuff. So I'm aware of who these people are, and you can kind of tell.
Do stars help you? If you hire a star at Politico, does that help you? Does the name recognition help you?
It helped tremendously 5 and 7 years ago. There's a diminishing return on just a name right now. Now, if that name is backed up with game, then it helps a ton. Like, there's just not that many people who can routinely tell you stuff you did not know that you want to know in a way that you want to read it. It's just, it's a tough thing to do. So if you're really a star and it's based on your performance, yes, it adds tremendous value. There's a lot of people who are stars. They have big names, but I don't really think they've got the game to back it up. They're living off a reputation that might have been true 5 or 10 years ago. It's not true today. I find zero value.
If you get somebody good, how do you keep them?
There's a couple ways you keep people. Ultimately, people want to feel like they're part of something big. I mean, I think that's one of the things we've been able to do at Politico and at Capital, that you're part of trying to save journalism. So, like, you feel like you're part of something. That's important. Compensation is certainly important. And then giving people opportunity to do things they couldn't otherwise do. You know, we're an ascendant media organization, and that means, like, each year we're still growing bigger and we're hiring more people. I don't say that to brag. I say that that's just a better environment to be in than being at a media company that is shrinking. Because it's not just the shrinking of seeing your friends and your colleagues getting laid off. It has a real psychic effect on people, in that you just feel like you're shrinking and you're worried about your job, as opposed to, I'm just here to do great journalism, so cut me loose, man.
And how did you capitalize it? In other words, you needed money to start it all, didn't you?
We did. We've got, you know, we hooked up with Robert Albritton, who is the publisher of both Capital and Politico. He's slightly older than I am. He's comes
43.
From a family. I'm 43. He's probably 44, 45. And he has, you know, the thing I didn't have and still don't have, which is he's got gobs of money, and he could fund this. And he had TV stations, he had a business, and he has a real passion for trying to save media. And so he's happy to fund it, because I think we're responsible with building a business. And that is, there's, to me, I just met with the Capital gang. There's nothing more important. I want to do great journalism, but I want it to be built on a business model where any company that we touch is around 10, 20, 30 years from now. That's a hard thing to do. And I think that we're able to do it. And, you know, I hopefully, you know, we've been blessed that we'll be continue to be able to do it. But that's really important. I don't want to just do things that feel good or sound good in the moment, but are not sustainable.
Okay,
sustainability is huge.
So let's talk about your business plan that you've just raised, Jim Vanderhyde. So how do you do it? I mean, how much do people have to pay to get political? And is there more than one service that you offer?
Oh, absolutely. So there's basically three ways that the business of Politico is three things. We sell high-end subscriptions, and those are to people that do this professionally. So they're a
lobbyist,
or they work at a trade association, or they're in government, or they're working as a political science professor. Like, they have a professional interest in this, because we're talking thousands of dollars.
You're not well. How many thousands?
The way we sell our subscriptions is we tend to sell them to entities. So we'll go to a trade association or a lobbying firm or a university and say it's at least $5,000 usually to get in. So that would get you 5 or 6 people can read all the content that we produce. And again, you'd only pay that money if you really need it professionally. So that's a part of it. And people, what I love is that people who pay it, they love it. They are grateful for it, because they're getting awesome content that they otherwise would not have, that makes them smarter and allows them to do their job more effectively.
So give us an example, Jim, of something that they recently got that they couldn't have gotten out of the Washington Post or the New York Times.
Oh, goodness. So anything. So
I'm not trying to be fresh.
No, not at all. I could tell you anything. So we could look at Capital, or we could look at Politico, but healthcare. We have now a Capital, 2 people covering healthcare policy here.
Now, Capital is the New York entity.
Capital is the New York entity.
Those of people who are just joining us, go ahead.
So Capital New York is the New York entity. Politico is the Washington-based entity. Between the two, we have now 10 people covering healthcare policy. So if you cared professionally about every nook and cranny about what's happening with implementation of the Obamacare healthcare law, how it affects business, how it affects individuals, how it affects premiums, at a level of specificity that the general audience would never need, we're the only place you can get it.
Do those players have the right, Jim, to call you and ask you to do something for them? In other words,
to
cover something? No.
No, and they never. The thing is, like, we've been at 7 years. Like, we've never really experienced any advertiser pressure or subscription pressure, because people get that, like, we're in it to do nonpartisan journalism, and they're not going to love everything we write, but if they respect what we write, that's all that matters. Here's why people should love the Politico model and the Capital model. So let's say we have 10 people covering healthcare. Well, because you've got this class of people who need the information professionally, well, 30% of the content that those reporters produce, we make available for free to everybody. Anybody who comes to Capital's homepage in New York or goes to Politico's homepage in Washington, It is free. We have found a way to have 10 people who can inform you with awesome expertise on what's happening on almost every policy issue, and a way to actually sustain that. So if you didn't have that model and you took it away, I believe that discourse would suffer, because you'd take all that expertise out of the system, because nobody else has figured out a way to be able to fund that type of coverage. And so we have two levels of Politico. Most people that know Politico or know Capital, they're not high-end subscribers. They're coming to it they're coming to the free side of Politico, the free side of Capital, which is literally scores, hundreds of items a day that they can have for free, because as a business, we can monetize it through advertising. And as the sort of public service dimension of why we got in this game in the first place, like, we think it's important to get people who care. And again, like, I distinguish that from the bulk of the population that doesn't really care about the delicacies or the intricacies of policy. But those that do care, they can come to both sites and they can be better educated than they would be going anywhere else. And it's free. And we really try to find those reporters who can write with some style and make this stuff accessible and make it fun and interesting. And when you get those things clicking together, it's a great business and it's a great journalistic enterprise.
And how do you sell? In other words, you have somebody goes around and salespeople who approach who approach a university and say, "Would you like our subscription?"
Absolutely. We have a big sales team both in Washington and in New York. Anybody who wants a subscription, either will just come to us and because they'll see one of our stories or one of our newsletters, or we'll figure out who are the different groups that should be subscribing. We have salespeople who are real experts in what is it that we offer, how do you utilize it so you get the maximum effect from it, and it's a big team that sells it. That's separate from advertising. We have a separate advertising sales team that goes out and tries to pitch different people who would want to advertise specifically to our audience. And that specificity makes the sale pretty easy. Most people that come to Capital or come to Politico, they're very familiar with what we do. If you're just a generalist, you wouldn't come to Capital or Politico. Like, you really only come to the site if you are either doing this stuff professionally, or you're like I was before I actually got into journalism. You just have a screw loose and you just care about this stuff in a way that the average Joe doesn't.
I'm up
care
in the
about.
Middle of the night from 1 to 2, and I'll take a look at the New York Times, the Washington Post, and I'll go to Politico every once in a while and say, well, what have they got? Because that's something that's, you know, interesting to me.
Now, the only flaw in that is you need to reverse that. You should be only going to Politico. Then you should go to the Washington Post and the New York Times and realize what inferior products they are to Politico.
Absolutely.
And then change your consumption habits
Absolutely
forever.
Right. Okay, so, Jim, I guess the next question is, let's get into Capital a little bit.
Yep.
Now, before we take a look at how the flea has jumped from Washington to New York State, let's compare, because this is something I've been interested in teaching this stuff for years and years. Yeah. What's the difference between Washington and New York when you cover them?
That's a good question. In some ways, I'd say since 2007, they've become closer. I feel like Washington and New York, particularly the financial side of New York and the regulatory side of Washington, you've created this one big, powerful glob of people in New York and Washington. So in some respects, you'd say, well, they're kind of similar. The big, big difference is you go to Washington and all you really got, it's kind of sad, all we got is politics. We might have the Nationals or the Redskins if that's your flavor, but we basically have politics. It is a truly a one company town. Whereas New York has, as you know better than I, it's like the diversity is huge, like the diversity of interests. So there's people who care a lot about politics, but there's people who care a lot about philanthropy or fashion or finance.
Certainly you have that.
But not to that degree. Like the almost everybody who's in Washington is obsessed at some level about politics and probably employed in some respect.
So in New York, you don't have a lot of people who take politics as seriously as they do in Washington.
Certainly, yeah. And if they do, they have other interests in a way you don't see in Washington.
Okay, but what about the mechanism of government?
Yeah.
In other words, in Washington, you got these people from all over the United States, caucuses, the Democratic study group, the conservative study group, the this, the that, and it's diverse. Whereas in New York, you really do have three guys running everything. You got a governor, you got the head of the Senate, and that's very different from what you have in Washington.
I did a little bit of homework about here, and I read your last column. I think you had talked about like there being essentially an oligarchy here. I would argue there's an oligarchy in Washington.
Well, there is.
There's a total oligarchy. Yeah. It's essentially the White House, it'd be the president and maybe his four or five top advisors. And all that really matters in Congress is your couple of congressional leaders, so that it's not that much different. You certainly have more diversity because you're dealing with 50 states and all the folks that come rushing into town as a result of that. But in both places, I think power is, this is true in most governments, like the power really is increasingly centralized in the hands of the very few. In a way, I don't think people often appreciate. I don't think it's sometimes hard to get people to pay attention to state politics and to really realize what you argue, which is there's not that many people who control things. It's the governor and maybe a couple other people. It's the mayor and maybe a couple other people. The same thing plays out in Washington. And we saw this a lot with President Bush. We see it a lot with President Obama, where even cabinet secretaries, it might be a cool job to say you have, but often it doesn't come with a whole lot of authority.
You're
a lot
under
of those
somebody's
marching,
thumb.
You're under somebody's thumb, exactly. Mm-hmm. It's usually a political appointee or buddy of the president.
I would argue with you, Jim, and probably be wrong, but I would argue with you that Albany is very different from Washington,
right,
simply because it's like a ebb and flow situation. They come in for a couple of months. They're only here for a couple of days. New York City is really where a lot of it is run out of,
yeah,
whereas Washington is a sort of permanent political place.
Absolutely.
That happens. So talk to me about why you started Capital.
Well, we had success that we talked about with Politico, and I think, you know, when you, again, I went from being my whole life as a journalist to now really thinking a lot about the business. And when you run a business, one of the temptations you have if you have success is you want to, well, I can do anything.
Sure.
And we've been really, I think, responsible. We do one thing really well. I don't know that we can do everything. And so we waited 7 years until we had a great sort of business management structure in place, and we wanted to test our model somewhere else. And New York is the perfect place to test it. And Capital New York, which had existed, you know, we purchased it late last year. It was a small publication, but it was run by people who I really found to be kindred spirits in their appreciation and love of journalism and their belief that there has to be a different, better way to save journalism, to fund journalism. And I'd known Josh and Tom, who are the co-editors of Capital. I'd known them for some time and kept in contact because we'd wanted to hire them years back. And once they wanted to sell, we wanted to buy. And we believed that you could take the model that we had just discussed and you could apply it to City Hall. You could apply it to here at the state capitol. And we're also trying it with the business of media to be able to fund very robust coverage in all those areas. So we have more reporters here than any other publication. We have more reporters covering City Hall than any publication and more covering the business of media. And the idea is not just to pound our chest and say, oh, look, we have more reporters. It's that because of the web and because of how people consume information and the fact that brand loyalty is slipping, if you can deliver the goods, you can establish a brand quickly. You don't have to wait 5 or 6 years for it to take root. You can really command the attention of an audience really quickly if you can do stuff that they feel they have to read
every day. So I guess my question, Jim Vanderhyde, is why New York and not California?
You know, I think one day soon we might be in California.
Was that the glint in the back of your eye, which is that sooner or later we're going to take all the major states and maybe all the states and replicate this model?
That would be my dream. I don't know that we'll accomplish it, but it would be my dream. And quite frankly, I think it should be a dream that if we can pull off, everybody in the world should be rooting for us. Because if you think about democracy and you think about journalism and you think about all the challenges, one of the biggest challenges is how do you continue to fund robust coverage of state capitals? New York is blessed in that you still have a pretty nice mix of publications that are here, that they're covering it in a serious way, people who are interested in it. But you travel this country, there are state houses that have big economies, that have huge sway over people's lives, and nobody's watching them.
Well, interesting.
Nobody's covering them.
Interestingly, all those years ago, 35, 40 years ago, I started a tiny little thing called the Legislative Gazette, still tiny, brings student journalists to Albany. They cover the legislature, and they put out this newspaper. And we've had visiting deputations from all over the country saying, we want one at our university. We want one in our state capitol. Never happened. Started in Colorado. Just what is it about New York that could support this that doesn't exist in these other places?
I think it's big. It's powerful.
Well, California's big. Sacramento's big.
There's some coverage of Sacramento, but I'm surprised by how little coverage there is of Sacramento.
Sure.
And you have, I would say, unlike California, you still have robust competition among the big daily newspapers in the city that still care a lot about what's happening in the state. They don't care as much, but they care enough. Whereas you have a lot of states where you have newspapers that don't care at all about what's happening at the state level. They've really become community focused. And so my hope and the big reason, getting back to your original question on why New York and why Capital New York, because it's the best place to test whether or not this model works, to perfect the model, and then try to take it to other states. That is ultimately the ambitions that we have with what we're doing with capital and what we'd like to do in other areas. And if you could do that, I think it would be a big achievement. I think it would be a big benefit to people in those states. I think it'd be a big benefit to journalism. I think it'd be a way to employ the people you're talking about at the Legislative Gazette. Sure. Those people might get interested in covering a state. They might have a passion for it. Who knows? They could be the next award-winning journalist. But if they don't have a place to work, they're going to go work somewhere else. They're not going to be in the business. And I believe that if you don't have people in the business keeping an eye on what's happening and informing the people who want to be informed, bad things happen.
Okay. Now, I read you from time to time. I don't read you enough. I should. And you're absolutely right.
That'll be your homework coming
out. I'm telling you that. Right. Okay. But I do notice something, and that is I personally believe your coverage of City Hall in New York City is more interesting than the coverage in Albany. I think the Albany guys are very good. You've hired some top people and you robbed from the best newspapers and things to do it. But I think the level of disinterest in Albany is appalling on the part of the population. But in New York City, they take their politics very seriously.
They do take it very seriously. I'm quite proud of the coverage we have both at the state level and at the city level. I think we have fantastic reporters. I would say we've been at it 6 months. My hope is like with each passing month, you get better. What we need to have happen is a year from now, you better be saying there's nobody that's even close to as good as these guys at covering the state. There's nobody as good as these guys at covering City Hall. Like that's like we have to be the dominant player in this space. That's why we got into it. That's the way you command the audience.
So who's the competition? I mean, you have the Albany Times Union.
Yeah.
I have a program here, the Media Project, with Rex Smith, who's the editor. And they have four or five people covering the legislature. That's a lot of people.
They do. They do it differently. They do it at a different pace, and they do it for a much broader audience. Again, like if you're writing for a newspaper, you have to sort of write for a lot of people who might only have a passive interest. We're writing for people who might be a smaller group of people, but who are just passionately interested in something that they have real expertise in. So you have to hire very sophisticated reporters. You often have to take them from competitors. You figure out who's the best in the business, bring them into your shop, and then train them
more
the way we do it. Yeah. And then pay them more and keep them doing what they need to do. And so the competition here would be certainly the newspaper would be a competitor. I think City and State is a competitor.
What about the New York Times?
You know, I mean, the New York Times is in theory is a competitor in that they have a presence here. But the New York Times, they don't cover sort of the nitty gritty of policy. They don't cover the nitty gritty of politics. They tend to swoop in and do either investigative pieces or sort of more pieces that are looking at it from 30,000 feet. And those are good pieces, and some of them we'd be very proud to have. But I don't consider them a direct competitor. And quite frankly, I just think that our product day in and day out is superior to theirs. Just like I would say the New York Times is a competitor to us at Politico. But I'd like to think that day in and day out, we clean their clock when it comes to covering politics. And we should, because we have way more people and they have 100 things to worry about. And we only have to worry about covering government, which is huge, but we're not covering like what's happening in fashion and what's happening in style and doing opinion. We're doing one thing, and that one thing we do, it has to be better. So like, the next time I'm on the program, I hopefully you're going to say, boy, I've been reading this all the time. I'm totally addicted, and it is so
you're
much
always
better
welcome here,
else.
Jim. Always.
Excellent.
And I mean that.
Yeah.
But I want to ask you, because I'm old, you know, I'm going to be 73 this year. So I've been covering this place for a long time. I've been sitting here and watching the legislature for a long time. And we've had several. The Legislative Gazette's always been there. We always mind our own business. We're not competing with anybody. It's a student training ground. But we've noticed a lot of people come and go over the years.
Yeah.
When will you know, if you fail, when will you know that you failed?
I don't want to sound cocky. I don't believe we can fail now. I believe that the early indications from the first 6 months make emphatically clear to me that this is going to be a successful business.
Are you making enough money to run it?
We're six months in. We're not profitable, but our plan is to hopefully be profitable by year three. The trajectory is great.
Okay.
We're ahead of what we thought we would be. So I'm virtually certain that this is a success. Now, is it a massive success where we'll have five times as many employees 3 to 5 years from now? I don't know. It's a success with the 50 employees we have, and I think we can make it even bigger. And I couldn't be more bullish on the team that we have and the opportunity that's before us. And I would look at our track record, the stuff that we've done in Washington. We don't get into markets where we're just going to be in and out. Like we're about to sign a new lease in New York City for our main headquarters there. It's a 5-year lease. This is a real commitment. There's a real financial commitment behind this because we believe in what we're doing. We're trying to build something that is sustainable. And I totally welcome skepticism whenever we do something new. And I think
I'm
people
not
should
skeptical.
Not
I
you,
want,
but I mean anybody.
I think people are
yeah. always skeptical. You know, yeah. not you, but I'm saying in general, people are skeptical. Can this work? Can it not work? What I love about the media right now, there's two ways to look at it. One, you can just be like, oh, man, everything is being destroyed around us. And what are we going to do? How do we hold on? I look at it differently. I say a lot of the old things that we had great attachment to that in their day were very good are being disrupted. And there's huge opportunities. Somebody smart is going to come along and figure out how to create the modern media company that can sustain great journalism.
It's
and
true.
I know there's an appetite for it. And so, and I just want to be, we just want to be one of the group of people doing that. And in this space, we want to be the dominant player.
But I want to know, Jim, why people don't care about politics, especially state politics, the way they should.
I guess the question, this is a good question. I'm going to throw a question back at you. Did they ever, though? Because we don't, now you can measure, you can actually look online what stories got read.
Sure.
Before, all you could really do is how many people subscribed to the newspaper, but we never know what page they made it to and what pieces. They might have just been looking at
the
comments.
I'm not letting you off the hook. Look, I spent my life as a professor and as a, you know, running this operation here at WMC. We have lots of programs about state politics and and the rest. There is a handful of people, obviously, who really care. And most people sort of throw up their hands and say, you know, they're all a bunch of crooks. They're all a bunch of this. And we're opting out of this. We don't care. And then they get the government, unfortunately, that they deserve. And so I'm wondering what your and obvious brilliant analytical abilities could tell us about how to get people motivated to care.
I think it's hard to get people motivated to care. And I don't mean to sound downbeat about it. I think there's a select group of people who are intellectually curious, who care a lot about what's happening in state politics or their local community or in Washington politics. It's often hard to get people to pay attention to Washington politics because of there is a cynicism that is very pervasive in our society. People don't believe in government officials. They don't believe in government. They don't believe, they just don't trust people.
What we see in the polls.
So the only, you restore that by having, I think, positive results, smart leadership, and show that government actually does something that does something appreciatively positive for people, that gets them reengaged in
the
process.
Are you optimistic about that, Jim?
I'm not terribly optimistic about it. I'm probably pessimistic about the general public getting reengaged in politics, because I believe that at the national level, which I believe shapes the perceptions of politics broadly, that it's getting worse, not better, and that almost every incentive that I know of in politics right now is for you to be more rigid and more crazy. And so if you want to get on cable TV, or if you want the outside groups to fund you, or if you want to get the activists fired up, there's huge incentive to be as nutty as you can possibly be. And nutty can be fun. And if you're a fellow nut, it can be thrilling. But for the 80% of the public that just wants to live their lives and get stuff done, it really turns them off.
Okay, so we have Eric Cantor. Explain what happened there.
I do believe that Eric Cantor is an anomaly. I don't believe it. It speaks to some broader trend other than there is what I just talked about, that there is huge dissatisfaction with big government, big establishment, big business. And I believe that he made a tactical mistake and that he became so obsessed with his own power in Washington that he lost some connection to his district. And he had a really compelling person come and run a very smart campaign in a very low turnout election that was able to surprise him and be able to win a race that nobody thought was winnable. And none of us, we spent a lot of time looking at the race, none of us really thought that it was winnable. Like, and that's what's great. I love politics. Like, one of the things I love about politics, I love Eric Cantor's defeat. I don't say that because I don't like Eric Cantor. I just love that something happened that nobody saw happening, because politics is not, as you know, as a professor, it's not really a science. There's very little that's precise about it. And it's kind of like economics. It's so amorphous in some ways. And so things happen that we can't explain or that we can't anticipate.
Well, you just explained it. You just said he didn't even show
theory,
up. He didn't show up in, but your theory is not alone. That he didn't show up in his district on election day. Bad arrogance, and thought he was more important than all of that. Are there elephants on the table? At least one senior thinker thought the fact that he was Jewish might have affected his loss.
I've seen that. I'm skeptical that explains his defeat. Best I can tell, he was Jewish in his previous elections, and the district hasn't changed that radically. So he's been Jewish. He's been defined as the most prominent conservative elected Jew of our time. So, like, people knew who he was and what he did and what his religion was. I think it really came down to he was what he is. Like, listen, the thing I love about politics, one of the many things, is that politics is an X-ray. You cannot hide yourself from voters. You can hide things. You cannot hide yourself forever. And I think what voters saw was reality. Eric Cantor was a hyper-ambitious guy who wanted nothing more than to be Speaker of the House and cared way more about that than he did about being home and tending to his constituents. Nothing wrong with
that. Not remembering that you can't, as Ethel Merman once sang, you can't have one without the other.
Right. You know, there was a good piece by Larry Sabato, a fellow professor at the University of Virginia, and he pointed out that for all the talk about this anti-incumbent wave, that 100% of Senate incumbents have now won their primaries, and 99% of House incumbents have won their primaries.
Okay, I want to stop you right there because we are running out of time. The Mississippi example.
Yep.
We saw, you know, a Tea Party type come along, narrowly edge out the establishment type. Is there a permanent establishment in the United States that we don't all see that somehow when things get really dangerous, you know, get busy and make sure that their people win?
No. I mean, there's certainly an establishment that wishes that were the reality. There's an establishment that sees itself as an establishment in the Republican Party, and it's your elected leaders. It's
well, you saw with Cochran, right?
And they, at times, I would say for the last 4 or 5 years, have been losing. They've not been able to exercise the power of the establishment. And I'd say now they're just doing the basic things that you need to do in politics, which is interfere in primaries, spend a lot of money, be aggressive in beating back people who might not be as electable, and they're having some success. And so I would not overinterpret the establishment's success. The establishment of the Republican Party right now is weaker or as weak as it's been in my lifetime. And that will continue to be the case. And the Tea Party might not be winning elections, but the Tea Party has won. They've already won.
Absolutely.
They've won the party. The party has been moved decisively to the right. They've redefined what an establishment candidate is. These establishment candidates, I'm using air quotes right now, but the establishment candidates are much more conservative than they used to be. And they're so the Tea Party has essentially won the ideological war. And what the establishment is doing is they're finally starting to spend money and resources to make sure that they don't end up with unelectable people. I mean, you think back to the Harry Reid campaign of a couple years ago when he's running in Nevada with 14% unemployment and a 40% approval rating, and they found the one woman in that entire state who could not beat Harry Reid, and they may put her as their nominee. They went into Delaware, and they took Mike Castle, who had run statewide 11 straight times for different offices and won every single time, and they found the one woman in that entire state who could not win that seat. They ended up not getting Mike Castle. They ended up getting Christine O'Donnell. Her first ad is, "I'm not a witch," and the rest is history.
Yeah.
So you can't have that. And they've basically, Republicans have erased that part of the weakness of their party, but it is still a Tea Party-dominated party, and it's still very difficult for the establishment, which is why Speaker Boehner has such a difficult time doing any of the things that he would like to do. Immigration reform, a grand bargain, anything.
Because he sees what you mentioned before, that unless the Republican Party, to some degree, reorients itself, they become the big losers. And that's what Boehner understands.
Absolutely.
And actually had a little courage and stood up and said so at one point, which said, follow me, as opposed to some of these guys who are on the extreme right.
The problem is they'd say, no, I won't follow you. I mean, they've not followed him other than not shutting down the government.
So is he done as Speaker?
No, it seems like he'll stick around for another couple of years. I thought every indication was that he would have left at the end of next year if Eric Cantor would have won and then would have become Speaker. I think now there's uncertainty. I don't know what else he would do. I guess he could become a lobbyist and make money, but I think he likes being Speaker of the House. It's not a great job right now because he doesn't control the vast majority of his conference. It's more conservative.
Who's the best politician in Washington?
That's a good question. I don't think there's anybody that really stands out as being there's good tacticians. Like I'd say Mitch McConnell's a good tactician when he's not distracted by his reelection campaign. I think Harry Reid is not necessarily a good tactician, but he's good at figuring out that when to throw a punch in a way that will allow him to do the dirty work for the Democratic.
Much underestimated, do you think?
Harry Reid?
Yeah. I mean, you don't hear much great about him.
Well, because he's not a big charismatic figure. He's he's a brawler. And I mean, brawling is good. I don't know that there's any political wizards right now in the White House. I watch them and they seem like a group of political thinkers that are really struggling to figure out how do you navigate what is a messy world in a messy Washington in a way that can lead to anything that could be defined as success. And I think they're really struggling.
Yeah. So the idea that you're up here means that you're taking this very seriously and that you're supervising things up in Albany.
Yeah, I had a great lunch with our gang. We try to, again, I'm a reporter at heart, so I love talking to reporters. So we had lunch with our reporters.
Where'd you take them?
Jax.
Yeah, Jax is famous. Yeah, indeed.
Jax is good.
Yeah, down the bottom of the hill. Okay, so anyway, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you.
I meant what I said. You are always invited back, Jim Vandehei. You know, it's been a most interesting hour. I wish you well in all of your endeavors. And it's incredible to see this kind of success, and we thank you for it.
Thank you for having me, and I'm going to take you up on that offer, and you're going to take me up on my offer. You're going to read Capital and Politico every day, and you're going to tell me 6 months from now that I changed your life in a very positive way.
Well, that'll be good. We've been talking with Jim VandeHei, who's president and CEO of Capital New York and co-founder of Politico. Jim, again, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.